last top negotiator says the upcoming talks with the remaining signatories of the 2015 nuclear deal will be aimed at the removal of anti-Tehran sanctions. Pakistan's foreign minister tells Press TV that his country and Iran have adopted a joint counter-terrorism strategy. Also coming up, Israel's plan to greenlight thousands of new settler units in the West Bank draws condemnations from the US, the UK and a dozen European countries. Thank you for joining us. A top story this hour, Tehran says the upcoming round of talks with the remaining signatories of the 2015 nuclear deal will be solely aimed at the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. Iran's deputy foreign minister and chief negotiator, Ali Bagher Ikhani, made the announcement upon his arrival at the Russian capital, Moscow. The Iranian diplomat is set to discuss bilateral ties and the latest regional and international developments with Russian officials. Bagher Ikhani's first official visit to Russia followed his meeting with the coordinator of the Joint Commission of the Iran Nuclear Deal, Enrique Mora, in Brussels. According to the Iranian diplomat, the new round of talks will begin before the end of November. The exact date will be announced next week. And joining us is Jason Anure, a political commentator. Jason, welcome. So what do you make of Iran's remarks here that the upcoming talks will be solely aimed at the removal of U.S. sanctions that were imposed unilaterally and not anything else?
Well, this is the correct place to start from. If we're talking about giving justice in this situation and returning to the JCPOA and acting in accordance to the spirit of the agreement, then that would be the logical place to start. Obviously, these last rounds of new sanctions, or repeated rounds of sanctions, mostly done by the Trump administration, were in violation of the agreement itself. And the U.S.'s withdrawal from the agreement, period, was a violation of the agreement itself. If we are to talk about having an honest return to this agreement, a real, genuine step towards trying to promote peace across the world, then this would be the starting point, the U.S. making up for its actions under the previous president in placing all these unfair restrictions on Iran. If that's what we're talking about, if we're talking about seriously having this agreement returned to, then the unjust actions of the U.S. must be dealt with. Me personally, I am not very optimistic that is going to be the case. That is where things should be. That is what should be done, because Iran desperately does need these sanctions removed. Many of them are even in violation of international law. Many of them are just killing Iranian, regular Iranian people, period. So we would like to see that this is the right thing to do, remove those sanctions, but I'm not optimistic that the United States will act honorably in this situation.
And, you know, Jason, when you hear Washington wanting to change or expand the original agreement to include, for example, Iran's defensive missile program, how does that reflect on the United States that signed an agreement? And then, you know, you can also argue, well, if you're going to talk about Iran's defensive missile program, why not talk about the U.S.'s aggressive missile program?
Well, that certainly is an important point. I think that the United States has changed its mind in that regard after the assassination of Soleimani, and the missile technology that was then used to strike back at the United States demonstrated a significant capability on the part of Iran. I think this was a bit of a wake-up call to Washington that that despite not having nuclear weapons, Iran certainly had a significant capability of defending itself and even striking back in that case. So I think that a lot of the desire to now change that agreement is about trying to undermine that capability that Iran has, which is, it's interesting for the United States to make such a complaint about Iran having such technology when, as you said, the United States has probably, confidently I could say, more missiles than anyone else in the entire world. And this is just the United States alone. This doesn't count many of the allies that the U.S. has inside the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia and Israel. Israel, which is known to have nuclear weapons, and if those weapons are aimed anywhere, they're very probably aimed at Iran right now. So this idea of trying to portray Iran as this great terroristic threat to the world is simply facetious in the face of the actual facts on the ground and who has been acting aggressively and who hasn't. I mean, the entire assassination of Soleimani was in complete violation of the law. If there was anything that would have violated the JCPOA, then that act alone would have done it. But we see the narrative that's being spun by the imperialists in this situation.
Jason, just expanding on that, just a little, 1 or 2 minutes further. We have seen Iran using its defensive. You cited the case of General Soleimani, where Iran used its missiles for retaliatory attacks against an act of state terrorism, an unlawful act according to the UN, by the United States. But it's been very limited, Iran's missile program. But on the other hand, we have seen America's missiles and their bombs in West Asia, in many countries being used in West Asia.
Well, the United States has dropped how many thousands of bombs a year inside of Afghanistan or inside of Iraq? I mean, the United States has a very long history of using bombings. Essentially, the entire northern half of the Korean Peninsula was completely wiped out by U.S. bombs, to the point where U.S. generals literally said on record, there's nothing left for us to bomb because everything had been destroyed. I mean, these are the people complaining that others would have some kind of, limited capability of defending themselves. It's very clear that through the last several hundred years, the 200 some odd years, ever since the birth of the United States, they have been the aggressors, they have been the murderers, they have been the killers across the entire world, and they're on no moral high ground to stand on whatsoever.
And then also U.S.-made weapons as well, Jason, like, for example, in Yemen and Palestine that are being used there. Jason, I'm going to have to wrap it up there. I'm afraid we have run out of time. Jason Anure, the political commentator, joining us live from the Niagara Falls, Ontario. Now, moving on, Pakistan's Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi says the United States' chaotic withdrawal and the fleeing of the former Afghan officials set the breeding ground for terrorist groups like Daesh in Afghanistan.
That is exactly what we were saying. Pakistan was advocating consistently withdraw, but do it in an orderly fashion, and that will help stabilize things in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, the way Ashraf Ghani and his entire team, the way they capitulated and left, that created such a uncertainty that elements like such took advantage of. And you saw what happened at the airport, where innocent lives were affected. So, yes, that sudden withdrawal contributed to the confusion.
The top Pakistani diplomat was speaking with Press TV. He said terrorism is one of the main challenges facing Afghanistan today. Qureshi said Islamabad does not want to see Daesh footprint expanding in the region, adding a coordinated approach is needed to address the problem. International assistance, Qureshi said, can help prevent the economic collapse of Afghanistan. The Pakistani foreign minister told us his country has not agreed to allow the U.S. to use its airspace for intelligence and military operations on Afghanistan. Regarding Iran, he said Tehran and Islamabad have recently increased their cooperation to stop terrorist attacks near their joint borders.
The spoilers within Afghanistan and beyond, who do not want to see stability in the region, right? They do not want to see stability within Afghanistan. So they always try to create misunderstandings. But fortunately, Pakistan, in the last 3 years since our government came into office, our bilateral relations with Iran have improved considerably. We have a mechanism in place now. We have structures in place through which we can coordinate, share intelligence.
Well, Qureshi highlighted the importance of Islamabad's recent agreement on counterterrorism with Tehran. He said the two sides have adopted a joint strategy to deal with terrorist attacks. Now, top Pakistani diplomats also said border violence has significantly declined in recent years. The two neighbors, he added, want to see a stable and peaceful region and are looking to expand their economic cooperation. The UN General Assembly's first committee has adopted an Iranian-drafted resolution calling on nuclear-armed states to dismantle their entire nuclear arsenal. The resolution calls for an end to production of nuclear weapons and requires nuclear-armed states not to transfer such weapons to other countries. It also calls on the Israeli regime to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and allow UN inspectors to access its facilities. The adopted text says non-nuclear states would be given assurances that they would not be attacked or threatened with nuclear weapons. The United States and the Israeli regime were among the countries that voted against the document. Political commentator Romero Funes says the powerful Israeli lobbies in the United States have allowed the regime to avoid being held accountable for its nuclear weapons program.
There's a complete double standard when it comes to Israel. Israel claims to be the victim. Israel claims to be the weaker underdog. And that's part of the Zionist narrative that they have. They view themselves as the underdog, as people who are oppressed. And there's actually a really disgusting concept in Israeli foreign policy called the Samson option, which is this idea that if other powers attack Israel, that Israel has the power and the capability to bomb the whole world and bring the whole world down with it. So there's some really vicious ideology in Israeli foreign policy. And unfortunately, the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, and all these Zionist organizations in Washington, D.C., they run the U.S. empire. They decide who gets criticized and who doesn't. And that's why we haven't seen any criticism of Israel the way we have of Iran.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has reacted to a new Israeli plan to construct more settler units on occupied Palestinian land. Hamas says Israeli settlement expansion is tantamount to its continued direct war against the Palestinian people. Hamas called on the Palestinian Authority to stop counting on the useless path of reconciliation and instead make Israel recognize Palestinians' rights. Hamas said inclusive and continued resistance against Israel can bring an end to its settlement expansion and free Palestinian land. The new Israeli plan involves the construction of more than 3,000 units in the occupied West Bank. The plan also drew criticism from a dozen European countries calling on the regime to immediately reverse its move. Israel's ally, the US, expressed concern as well. Israel is expanding its settlements despite UN resolutions calling them illegal and urging a halt to them. Political commentator Paul Larudi says Israel knows that Western governments are not sincere in their criticism of the regime's illegal settlements construction.
Strong language is like strong water, you know. I mean, what is strong water as compared to strong tea or strong coffee? It's nothing. It's empty of everything. This is a charade that has been played. How do we know that it's a charade and that it's insincere? Because every time in the past that these words have come out of government spokespersons, nothing has ever been done. So this is a pure charade. It's for public consumption. It's for image. That's it. Israel is not going to respect what the United States says, and the United States knows that Israel is not going to respect what it says, and Israel knows that the United States knows that it's not going to respect it. So it's nonsense. There's no point to it at all. Israel is going to go ahead and do what it has always done from the beginnings of the Zionist movement, where the housing has been a military strategy. It has been a strategy for taking land.
Demonstrators have hit the streets of Sudan's capital Khartoum for a fourth straight day to protest the coup by the military. The protests turned violent with clashes between security forces and the protesters. Medics say a demonstrator was killed and several others were injured. The death brings to 8 the number of protesters killed in Khartoum and its sister city, Omdurman. Since the Monday coup, dozens have been arrested too. Despite the crackdown, mass rallies are planned for the weekend. State officials have also promised disobedience to oppose the military takeover. Outside Sudan, there have been reactions as well. The UN Security Council has urged the military to restore the civilian-led government. The World Bank and the US have frozen aid, while the African Union has suspended Sudan's membership. Ted Coffey is a broadcaster and media consultant in London. Earlier, we talked to him about the situation in Sudan. He believes that a return to complete civilian rule will not happen rapidly in the African country.
2023 is a long time away. And actually, the ongoing discussion in Sudan has been the rapid return to complete civilian rule. Many people have said that the because of Omar al-Bashir's very long, approximately 20-year tenure of office, the roots of the military have penetrated deep into the society, and so it's very difficult for them to not only get out of government but also stay in the barracks. So no, I don't think anybody is holding their breath. Nobody is impressed by this declaration that they're going to go back to civilian government in 2023. If it's difficult for Sudan to keep up, Africa and the rest of the world has a certain momentum. And I would suggest that it's not going to break its momentum so that Sudan can catch up. I think that General al-Baram has some very, very deep thinking to do.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Amazon and Google are actively working to build and improve the technological infrastructure the Zionist regime needs to surveil Palestinians and confine them to the ghettos the Israeli regime's army has created for them. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Jonathan Cook, journalist. This article is published under the heading Amazon and Google, Partners in Israeli Regime Apartheid. Stay tuned for more. The best-selling Irish novelist Sally Rooney is openly shunning the Israeli regime after recent reports from human rights groups warn that the Zionist regime practices apartheid, systematically oppressing Palestinians under its rule. But while the Israeli regime risks becoming a pariah among some cultural producers, it is being aggressively embraced by globe-spanning corporations like Amazon and Google, among the wealthiest companies in history. The two tech giants are not just lining up to do business with the Israeli regime, they are actively working to build and improve the technological infrastructure the Israeli regime needs to surveil Palestinians and confine them to the ghettos the Israeli regime's army has created for them. Through their collaboration on the Zionist regime's Project Nimbus, both companies are helping to remove any pressure on the Israeli regime to make peace with the Palestinians and are instead becoming partners in Israeli regime apartheid. Now, workers for both companies are speaking out, most of them anonymously for fear of what they call retaliation. This month, some 400 employees of the two companies published a letter in the Guardian newspaper warning that Amazon and Google were contracted to supply dangerous technology to the Israeli regime military that would make this regime's rule over Palestinians even crueler and deadlier. The $1.2 billion contract for Project Nimbus awarded earlier this year means the two tech firms are to build data centers in the occupied territories on behalf of the Israeli regime military. Senior staff will need the Israeli regime security clearance to work on the project. In a sign of how aware the Zionist regime is of the potential backlash against Amazon and Google's involvement, the contract bars the tech corporations from withdrawing due to pressure from either employees or growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement. The terms of the contracts are also being kept under wraps to prevent scrutiny. The tech giants' wish to avoid publicity is understandable. Each pays lip service to ethical business practices. Google claims that firms can make money without doing evil, while Amazon's leadership principles state a commitment to make better, do better, and be better. Providing the Zionist regime with the technological tools to better enforce both its belligerent military occupation and its apartheid policies privileging Jews over Palestinians looks suspiciously like making a lot of money from colluding with evil. In the words of the whistleblowing staff, Amazon and Google's collaboration allows further surveillance of and unlawful data collection on Palestinians and facilitates expansion of the Zionist regime's illegal settlements on Palestinian land. Neither Amazon nor Google responded to a request for comment on the concerns raised in the letter. Two employees, Gabriel Chabiner, a software engineer at Google, and Bathul Sayed, a content strategist at Amazon, went public on NBC's website shortly after publication of the letter in The Guardian. They gave examples of how the Zionist regime would be able to use Amazon and Google's computer services to help enforce the occupation. Data would be used to identify Palestinian homes for demolition in what are often moves towards land clearances by the Israeli regime to build or expand illegal settlements. And the information collected and stored on the services would guide attacks on build-up areas in Gaza, which the Israeli regime has been blockading for the past 15 years. In previous military campaigns, the Zionist regime has bombed Palestinian hospitals, schools, and universities. Amazon and Google servers will also assist the Zionist regime's Iron Dome missile interception system, which has helped the Israeli regime neutralize rockets from Gaza so that it can maintain an enforced quiet from Palestinians as it keeps them caged and imposes a starvation diet for the enclave's inhabitants. The two employees also noted that Amazon and Google will be directly implicated in the Israeli regime's wider apartheid policies of the kind criticized earlier in the year by human rights groups, including the Israeli regime occupation watchdog B'Tselem. Nimbus will serve the Israel Land Authority, which not only allocates lands for illegal settlements, but oversees discriminatory policies in land allocation inside the occupied Palestinian territories that openly privilege Jews over the fifth of the Israeli population who are Palestinian natives. The Zionist regime claims these so-called Israeli Arabs are equal citizens, but they suffer systematic discrimination, as B'Tselem and New York-based Human Rights Watch have highlighted. Amazon and Google have ignored previous calls from staff to prioritize Palestinian rights over increased profits from colluding in Israeli regime's war economy. In May, many hundreds again anonymously urged both companies to sever their ties to the Israeli regime military shortly after it killed almost 260 Palestinians, including more than 60 children, in an attack on besieged Gaza Strip. Figures published this month demonstrated the Israeli regime's central place in the global digital economy. Despite its tiny size, the Israeli regime's share of high-tech investments now amounts to a third of those made in European countries. The fake regime of Israel has particularly benefited from growing demand in the West for its surveillance technologies, cyber weapons, and developments in militarized artificial intelligence. The Israeli regime military and offshoot startups launched by retired troops have a competitive edge, claiming that their technologies have been battle-proven on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. According to reports in local media, the Zionist regime is poised to become a global data crossroads. In addition to Amazon and Google, Microsoft, Oracle, and IBM are all expected to build server farms in occupied territories to cash in on the greater integration of digital and military technologies. The critical role of the Israeli regime in high tech, from its Intel chip plant to firms like AnyVision and Onavo that offer specialized surveillance, facial recognition, and data mining technologies, means no one can afford to fall out with the Israeli regime. Google and Facebook have already faced criticisms for their work with the Israeli regime censoring Palestinians on social media or making them invisible on online maps. Getting either Amazon or Google to honor their public commitments to ethical behavior by withdrawing from Project Nimbus may prove much harder, and not only because of the contractual obligations the Israeli regime has insisted on. The Zionist regime has become too integral to the global surveillance and war industries for any tech giant to risk antagonizing it, with profits galore to be derived from closer collaboration with the military-industrial complex. The pressure will be on to forge closer bonds with the Israeli regime, whatever its human rights record. And with the Zionist regime lobby deeply ensconced in Western capitals, the tech corporations will not wish to risk the reputational damage of being tarred as anti-Semitic for boycotting the Israeli regime. Pressure may be mounting on many companies 2002 distanced themselves from the Israeli regime over its occupation and apartheid policies. But for Amazon and Google, it is those very practices of occupation and apartheid that are a tech seam waiting to be mined.
Food for thought.
Salam, and how about listening to a thought-provoking saying from Imam Ali, peace upon him, the vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Do not make a sinner despair. Many of the sinful enjoy a happy end on repentance, while many of the seemingly devout rupture their deeds and deserve hell. Allah may protect us from hell.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Quraysh. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. As for kindness to people, it plays an important role in strengthening social ties and spreading love and friendship among people. Islam has urged Muslims to cling to kindness to people. Imam Abu Ja'far al-Baqir, peace be upon him, has said, "Continuous kindness is the best means with me." The most lovable things with the Imam, peace be upon him, was continuing kindness to people, for he wanted to plant love and affection in their hearts through it.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the divinely appointed imam from the household of the Holy Prophet, has these beautiful conversations and these beautiful dialogues with his friends and his relatives, his companions, his family members, and the people in general. We find that in one such conversation, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam talks about a very interesting thing when asked about some advice as regards to good deeds. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, "Regard the good deed, the good action, as small. Do it quickly and conceal it, hide it." Now, dear brothers and sisters, dear friends, it seems that this is a very small piece of advice in this conversation. It almost seems inconsequential, but really it's quite profound when you open up the chapters which are being revealed in this divine book. First and foremost, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, "Regard the good deed as small." Meaning, don't become arrogant when you do a good deed. Don't become proud and haughty and in everybody's face, showing off. "Look at me, I did a good action." No, within yourself and even manifesting it outwardly, regard the good action as small and pray to Allah that Allah accepts this good deed. The next thing is do it quickly. Of course, we find in the traditions that it is said that Satan, the devil, will do his very best to stop you from doing a good deed. So the Ahlul Bayt, on the other hand, the household of the Holy Prophet, and here Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has taught us, do the good deed quickly so that you are not dissuaded or tempted from not doing it. And the final one is to conceal this good action. Don't show off to other people. Don't show off that you are doing a good action. Conceal it. Hide it as much as you can. As it is said in certain places in the traditions, that sometimes give charity in a manner where the left hand does not know that the right hand has given charity. Conceal it and keep it for Allah. This is Dialogue Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
What was not discussed is now being discussed. What was given to the masses as the sunnah of the Prophet, which wasn't, is now being cleared up, is now being corrected. So all in all, what we can say is, after a time of misinformation about the teachings of the Prophet, along with some information, the words of Ali ibn Abi Talib were around, the words of Imam al-Mujtaba were around, the words of Imam al-Hussein were around, but amongst a smaller group of people. The masses heard some of the words of the Prophet. They weren't all gone. Some of the words of the Prophet were truly passed on. There were people that received it. Later on, those were recorded. Those were not followers of the Ahlul Bayt, who do not try to get the knowledge of the Sunnah of the Prophet through the Ahlul Bayt, which is the source that the Prophet himself encouraged, although we don't say other sources, if reliable sources, that we're not going to hear what they have recorded. But these are the people that know it more accurately and know more of it, more details of it, and have understood it on a different scale. So if others share it, we check with the Ahlul Bayt. This is how we conduct ourselves. This is how we approach hadith. If Abdullah ibn Umar says that the Holy Prophet said something or another, you say, okay, Abdullah ibn Umar, according to history, was not seen to be a liar. We do not have that. He made mistakes, sure, but he was not one of the ones who fabricated. If he says he heard the Prophet say something, like, okay, we will see if it doesn't conflict with anything else, if it's in line with what the Ahlul Bayt have said, the Prophet has said, then okay, we'll accept the direction that it had without the input of Imam Zain al-Abidin, and then building off of that Imam al-Baqir, it would not have moved towards compilers of hadith, compiling these ahadith and trying to filter out the wrong, filtered out the ones that are not acceptable and taken and presented those which are acceptable. This would not have been the result of the direction of the Muslim community without the input of Imam Zain al-Abidin and afterwards Imam al-Baqir. And specifically what we're focusing on here is Imam al-Baqir's effort.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
the light.
Meet Clarion, a homemade polar bear whose mission is to raise awareness of climate change in a 500-kilometer pilgrimage to Glasgow. The 3-meter polar bear is work of British furniture maker Bamber Hoss. The bear weighs 17 kilograms and is made of bamboo, willow, and tissue paper. Hoss started his journey with Clarion from his hometown of Bishop's Castle in England to Glasgow. They accomplished their spectacular journey ahead of the United Nations COP26 climate conference in the Scottish city. Hoss says Clarion is a symbol of melting Arctic ice caps due to global warming.
He's called Clarion. Clarion the bear is not a bear. He is a metaphor. He's a symbol. It is a very obvious symbol that a polar bear represents the Arctic, not the Antarctic, and that is where, you know, some of the problems are with melting ice caps. Not all the problems, because they're elsewhere as well.
Hoss says his aim is to encourage people to pay attention to climate change. Environmental activists from across the UK and elsewhere on the continent have also embarked on a long journey on foot to reach the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow.
Flocks of sheep are on the streets of Madrid. The animals have made their way through the center of the Spanish capital to follow ancient migration routes. Shepherds accompanied their sheep and goats moving through the streets of the Spanish capital. They actually marked a centuries-old annual tradition that began in 1994. The event allows shepherds to migrate their cattle from summer to winter pastures. They do so based on a deal struck in 1418 that allows the animals to walk through the city freely. The event attracts hundreds of people. It was canceled last year due to the pandemic, but this year, many locals came out to watch.
The Philippines is among the countries facing a soaring plastic waste crisis. However, a group of recyclers are working hard to tackle the problem, turning the waste into building materials. The group is called the Plastic Flamingo, or simply the PLAF. They gather bottles, single-use sachets, and snack food wrappers. The waste is then shredded and molded into post-add planks that can be used for decking and fencing. Their products are also durable enough to make disaster relief shelters and urban furniture. The group says the coronavirus pandemic has worsened the plastic waste problem, sparking a rush for protection equipment. Their disposal is a matter of concern now.
Because of the plastic problem we're currently facing, the pandemic, the huge accumulation of plastic use, there's also improper disposal. People are unaware on, you know, how do I dispose these plastics? Where do I dispose of them? So at the same time, we give that avenue also that instead of putting it in landfills or oceans in general, you know, you give it to the PLAF, you give it to recycling centers like us, and we would recycle these, upcycle them into better products.
The PLAF says surging online shopping is also another problem that they try to address. The group has collected over 100 tons of plastic waste since it started the business in 2019. However, they still have a lot to do. A UN report says some 300 million tons of plastic waste are produced annually, with South Asian countries accounting for 60% of it. A North Macedonian zoo has a new inhabitant. It may be small, but it has certainly sparked a big amount of joy. The baby marmoset was born 3 weeks ago. Its parents are super protective of their precious offspring. That's why zoo staff have not been able to get close to the baby and determine if it's a male or a female. The tiny primate will be given a name after its sex is known. Marmosets are the world's smallest monkeys. On average, they are about 13 centimeters long and weigh up to 100 grams. The adorable animals can be found in a number of countries in the Americas.
The hustle and bustle of modern life has made it difficult to communicate with nature the way humans used to do a few decades ago. Now a giant statue in the state of New York reminds us of the importance of lending an attentive ear to our surroundings. The massive statue named Water's Soul is located along the Hudson River. Her woman's head, with her index finger pressing on her lips, seems she's asking bystanders to maintain silence. It's a work of 66-year-old Spanish artist Juanme Palenza. He says the message of his work is, quote, to call on people to listen to the profound noise of the water talking to us. Water Soul was made of polyester resin, fiberglass, and marble dust at a Barcelona studio. It was later shipped to its Jersey City site for assembly. The sculpture is 24 meters tall.
You might have heard of Iran's stellar wrestling achievements or about its soccer team, but that's not all. Another sport has grabbed attention too. Golfers now competing during Iran's national golf tournament in Tehran. This year, 90 participants from around the country played on a very unique golf course. It is only 13 holes instead of the standard 18, but that hasn't stopped golf enthusiasts playing the 13 holes and then repeating the last five to complete the tournament. The good news is that the golf course might not stay so small for long. Iran's Golf Federation hopes to bring in more people interested in golf. But for this to happen, the infrastructure must be provided first.
We don't have the space to use the 350 instructors to train the 3,000 registered men and women across the country, so we decided to build a national academy off the golf course. Course number 18 will be used in a competition venue during tournaments and as a training and education venue during non-competition times.
When the course was built decades ago in northern Tehran, it had five more holes. But over the years, fairways were laid across parts of the field, reducing playable footprint. Tehran's golf club has about 300 members, half are women. Golf has been around in Iran for over a century, and most of the courses are in southern provinces.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Concerned about endangered animals? If yes, then it will be good news that a Mexican zoo has welcomed a newborn zebra. It belongs to the most threatened of the three species of zebra in the world. The foal made a public appearance Thursday, 10 days after it was born at a zoo in northern Mexico. It's about 50 centimeters tall. Its weight, between 10 to 15 kilograms. The newborn equine raises hopes for the conservation of the imperial zebra species.
We are the only zoo in Mexico that has this species of zebra. Unfortunately, it is an endangered species. Here at the zoo, we are doing everything possible to preserve and produce them so that in the future we can repopulate some other parks.
The imperial zebra is native to Africa. It is the largest of the wild equids, the family of horses, donkeys, and other animals. Currently, there are less than 2,500 of imperial zebras in the wild. That's blamed on the destruction of their habitat, illegal hunting, and lack of food.
The world's largest Ferris wheel has opened to public in the United Arab Emirates. Dubbed the Dubai Eye, the wheel takes the visitors to a height of 250 meters. Feast their eyes on the city skyline. That is almost double the height of the iconic London Eye and over 80 meters taller than the high roller in the U.S. city of Las Vegas. Each full rotation of the giant structure takes 38 minutes. The city put on a spectacular firework and light display to celebrate the opening. The 38th edition of the International Short Film Festival has kicked off in the Iranian capital, with some 63 films from 32 countries competing in the event. The festival has for the first time turned into an Oscar qualifying event, giving winning entries a shot at the Academy Awards. This is being held at Tehran's famous Iran Mall cinema complex, and it will showcase short feature, documentary, and experimental works. 5 Iranian films and 58 from abroad are selected for the grand prize, and the winner will be presented to the Academy for possible Oscar nomination. The jury has members from Iran as well as Italy, Japan, and France. The festival will be running until October 23rd.
Natural disasters often disrupt normal life, but that's not the case with an Indian couple who got married despite their town being submerged by floodwaters. The couple, identified by local media as health workers in Kerala State, managed to reach a temple for the wedding in a giant cooking pot. They could be seen smiling and waving in their ceremonial clothes while two of their relatives were steering the pot. The couple reportedly borrowed the pot from the temple, saying that was the only option available. The pair was unwilling to postpone their big day, adding an unforgettable story to a country that is famous for many incredible things. Feeling down, it's all right to cry and get help. That's all what a place called the Crying Room tries to tell its visitors in Spain. The Crying Room is part of a building located in central Madrid. It's free and open to the public. The Crying Room aims to remove the stigma attached to mental health, crying, and seeking help. It offers a wide range of services, from a corner to crying, to a phone with a list of psychologists people can call. Motivating messages are also visible on the walls. People have hailed the initiative, saying it helps them speak out about their negative emotions.
I think it's an excellent idea to visualize the widespread of the mental health issue. And I think it's a really fun take on it, to call it the crying room, because of the Spanish expression, if you want to cry, go to the crying room. So it's kind of stigmatized to cry in Spain, as in many other countries. So I wanted to take part in this this visualization of the problem.
The Crying Room was opened in an effort to raise awareness about mental health and well-being. Official data in Spain showed that around 40% of people had symptoms of depression last year. Another 30% experienced anxiety.
The first movie in orbit in the making. Two Russian nationals who travel to the International Space Station to shoot scenes of that movie are now back on Earth. The Soyuz MS-18 spacecraft carrying an actress and a film director undocked from the ISS early Sunday and successfully touched down in Kazakhstan about 3 hours later. The film crew, along with a veteran astronaut, blasted off from the Russian leased Baikonur Cosmodrome earlier this month. They spent 12 days in the ISS to shoot the scenes. The mission beats